Welcome to the Loins of History, a podcast connecting the past to the present and improving historical and political literacy. I'm your host, Colin, and I'm joined by my co-host, Jay. Today, we're going to continue our series on the fall of the French Third Republic and discuss the Munich Conference today. But before we dive into that, Jay, I believe there's some shout-outs and some new comments that we need to give.
Yeah, that's right. Thanks, Colin. Give a shout out to our new subscribers on YouTube. We have Ian Hintz, Evan H., Kyle Scott, Area 9879, Ashki, Igor Santos, Patrick Houston, Tyler Miller, Adelise Westy, Danielson, John Erickson, Alex Tempest, Dennis Walton. Thank you for our new subscribers on YouTube. And want to give a couple shout outs to some really nice comments we got also on YouTube. Username Resident Eyebrow Appreciator. Thanks for the suggestion on German unification. Would love to talk about that someday. A lucky no lie. Okay, bye bye. Thanks. Thanks for the comment. Where's William 488? A Ty Miller. And a Cheerio 2298. Thanks for the comments, guys. We appreciate the encouragement and the support. If you, just a reminder to all our other listeners, we like giving shout outs to everybody. So if you leave a comment, give us a 5-star review, a like, a subscribe, something where we can see your name on a lot of the different platforms. If you just like, we can't see who you are that liked it. But if you comment, if you subscribe, we can subscribe on YouTube. If you're on Podcast Addict or Apple or Spotify, we can't see who you are if you subscribe there. So thanks for supporting this podcast. We really like the encouragement and the support. And hopefully we are continuing to make progress towards building resolute men and women with a proper understanding of history. Okay, so we are progressing in the slow train wreck that is the fall of the Third Republic, which, just as a reminder, you know, the French Third Republic lasted from about 1871 to 1940 in World War II. And this series has been asking questions: why do civilizations collapse? Why do civilizations fall? We've talked about the Roman Empire. We've talked about the Han Dynasty. We've talked about the Byzantine Empire. We've talked about the Bronze Age collapse. And now we're talking about the French Third Republic. And where we're at in this series is, you know, last week we talked about the remilitarization of the Rhineland. We saw how divided France was and is, you know, at this time. And we saw that primarily really due to weak leadership who was trying to cater to public opinion and the opinion of other people outside, primarily Great Britain, that last major defense, that last major linchpin in French security, you know, the Germans not being able to station troops and build fortifications in the Rhineland, was really, you know, a lost opportunity and went a long way to leading to World War II. And what we'll see today is now France beginning, along with Great Britain, beginning to abandon its allies. And I think there are a lot of lessons for us to learn here, principles for us to derive for America and the West today, specifically in this matter. You know, the remilitarization of the Rhineland was so much of a self-inflicted wound. This is, you know, when we abandon collective security, when we abandon other like-minded nations that play a role in our own security, that can lead to extremely unhelpful and disadvantageous situations for us as well. All right, so in this episode, we're going to talk about the Munich Conference, which happened in September 29th and in the morning of the 30th in 1938. We're first going to talk a little bit about the background, kind of what got us there earlier in the year of 1938. Then we're going to talk about like the immediate, you know, week or two prior to the conference in September. We're going to talk about the conference itself, which was a day long. And then we're going to talk about kind of the aftermath and, you know, implications from what happened at that conference. So going a little bit into the background. So in March of 1938 was the Anschluss of Austria, which was a huge, turning point, a huge event that took place, leading to World War II. I'm not going to go into too much detail on how that event occurred, but for, this episode is primarily focused, and the Munich Conference is primarily focused on Czechoslovakia. But if for those of us that know our geography, prior to the Anschluss of Austria, Nazi Germany only shared, it shared a large border, but it was really just the north/northwest part of Czechoslovakia. Germany didn't more or less surround what's now known as Czechia. Those of us who are millennials might know it as the Czech Republic. But if you're a real good student of history, that area of Europe was for a long time known as Bohemia, essentially, centered on Prague. The two historical that make up Czechia is Bohemia and Moravia. Bohemia and Moravia being a traditional part of the Holy Roman Empire. But with the Anschluss of Austria, now the Third Reich completely surrounded Bohemia. Vienna is south of Prague. And there's basically just this state that's jutting into the Third Reich. And Hitler was like, now it is time to go after Czechoslovakia. Well, Czechoslovakia for years had been building extremely strong defenses.
Aren't the Czechs, you're talking about the Czech defenses, aren't they the ones that are famous for those anti-tank barriers with the kind of the steel X's? I can't remember what they're called off the top of my head, but they're...
I don't know what they are.
It's called a Czech hedgehog. It's one of those bits of information that you read about in a World War II book in fifth grade, and it's just stuck in the back of your mind for years, and you just ignited a core memory right there.
Nice.
Sorry. And was there also a sizable German population in Czechoslovakia?
Yeah. So yes.
And I don't want to jump ahead.
Yeah. Well, so that there was, but from a, and this is the thing about Hitler, Hitler was a more or less operational genius. So in the way Western militaries think of this now, this is a Clausewitzian way to view war, and that is there's three levels. There's the strategic, the operational, and the tactical, with the tactical being engagements in battles, the strategic, the high level, being national policy objectives. Sometimes, especially in the British school of thought, they call this the grand strategic level, which is politics and policy. And then they call the strategic level a military level of how it integrates into politics. But Clausewitz didn't do that. He just called it the strategic level, which I think there's good value to that. And then there's the operational level, which is what connects the two, right? The reason why I say Hitler was a great operational leader was he made some huge strategic blunders, but he was a mastermind at not the 6 inches in front of his face, maybe the 18 inches in front of his face, but then he couldn't see beyond that. And when, Czechoslovakia had built all of these defenses right on the border, and they were good. They were not quite Maginot Line style defenses, but they would have seriously complicated, even in 1938, the Wehrmacht, the Russian army, was not full strength by any stretch of imagination. The Luftwaffe was pretty good, but there was a lot of problems with the Wehrmacht. So Hitler thought, I want Czechoslovakia. How do I, is there a political opportunity here? And he saw, to your point, Colin, that there were a lot of Germans, ethnic Germans, in the area known as the Sudetenland. The Sudetenland was not a defined area. The Sudetenland was kind of not made up, but not that big of a deal. That area was never a part of Germany, so to speak. That area is very much Bohemia or Czechia as we know it now. Those were very traditional borders that never belonged to Prussia or anything like that. So, or Bavaria for that matter. So That's why Hitler started ranting and raving about the Sudeten Germans. And they were very much like, I mean, there were a lot of Germans. And at this time, you know, nationalism is a very strong thing. Like even the Germans themselves, like there would be things in the European, pan-European press about the Sudeten Germans and how they wanted to go back to Germany or be a part of Germany, etc. It's also important to know at this time, just again, part of background, that Czechoslovakia had treaties of mutual assistance with both France and the Soviet Union at this time. And when we say treaties of mutual assistance, it was like a very broad type alliance. And when I say broad, it was like basically defensive in nature, but it didn't explicitly say that. And it didn't actually guarantee. So part of the problem here was France had a much tighter military relationship with the Poles. The French and the Poles were allies for a long time. But like the Czech general staff and the French general staff were not talking. So it was like kind of this ambiguous and blurry treaty of mutual assistance. They were supposed to help if somebody attacked them. Same thing for the Soviets. Neither France nor the Soviet Union shared a border with Czechoslovakia. So that kind of led to a lot of like questions of like, okay, if Germany actually attacks Czechoslovakia, what are we going to do? How are we going to get troops in there? And that caused some problems. So, okay, next point that's important to bring up. The role of Neville Chamberlain in Great Britain. Like, yes, this is, you know, a series on the fall of France. However, Great Britain itself played a huge role in the fall of France. Like, you know, we talked our last episode about how it was a bad idea for France to abandon an independent foreign policy. And one of the reasons why is because Great Britain led them down bad paths. And in earlier, like after the annexation of Austria, Neville Chamberlain was, I don't want to beat up on the guy unfairly, but his entire policy was Hitler's not that bad of a guy. Hitler is reasonable and rational. All he needs is like, all of our problems can be solved through diplomacy and conversation and working things out. He believed Hitler had good intentions. He obviously, as we know, was 100% wrong. And even at the time, you know, we know now through a lot of these captured German documents after World War II, that like Hitler had already made these decisions to start the war. It's not a matter of like Hitler. There was no world in which Hitler didn't see World War II coming, like in that he didn't see himself as being the instigator for World War II.
I'll talk more on this when we talk kind of go through the episode and referencing leaders. But I mean, this is kind of a semi defense of him, not really even a defense, but maybe an understanding. I think he was just the wrong leader at the time. Chamberlain may have been able to effectively govern Great Britain post-World War II or even like in the 20s or something like that, but he was thrust into one of the most cataclysmic events in world history and suddenly asked to stand up to one of the greatest villains. Mm. It's kind of like, well, yeah, maybe he was just relying on all the knowledge and experience and talent he had, which just was not enough. As great as it could have been on paper, it was not enough in those moments. So it's easy for us to look back and say, Chamberlain got it wrong. He messed all this up. He could have stopped it. It's like, yeah, but to be honest, a lot of our leaders now or recently or just in the past could have been great in another time or could have been good. He was just in the wrong place at the wrong time, so to speak. And that's not a defense. That's just kind of an understanding of the situation he was in.
I am all for showing historical sympathy to people, even that we don't agree with.
Great way to say it.
It's, you know, as a historian, it's super easy to second guess, you know, in hindsight, decisions that people made a long time ago. And there's so many implications to that. We have to be careful as historians and as, you know, good citizens to not especially ethically speaking, like to not, you know, pronounce ethical judgment on people that we probably would have made similar decisions if we were in their shoes at that time, right? The one, not pushback, but the one other thing I'd say about Chamberlain was there were people telling him he was making the wrong decision. And as a matter of fact, we'll see Churchill later was like booed in the House of Commons because he basically said Chamberlain's an idiot. And I'll read that quote at the end of the episode here, but there were voices at the time. As a matter of fact, you know, to get a little bit ahead, even when Chamberlain flew to Munich to the Munich conference, he was ridiculed by the opposition in Great Britain. So yes, public opinion very much wanted appeasement, but at least the political opposition within Great Britain and people speaking to his face, Churchill just being one, they were telling him he was making the wrong decision. So, but yeah, I'm all for giving.
I say it's partial sympathy. Partial sympathy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So what we see here in this episode and kind of, you know, how this relates to France is Chamberlain's view was we can negotiate with Hitler, we can avoid war. France did not have a strong enough leader. France did not really have anybody. That's why when we talk about Munich, it's exclusively focused on Hitler and Chamberlain. The reason why we don't talk about Daladier, who was the prime minister and the minister of defense at the time, was because like Daladier was like not a very strong leader. He wasn't a bad dude. He was very much like a moderate slash leaning conservative. You know, the Daladier government came into power after Leon Blum and the Popular Front, which was like the socialist and radical socialist and communist government, like completely collapsed prior to 36. So anyway, like Daladier wasn't a bad guy. He was just a weak leader and he couldn't articulate an independent foreign policy apart from Chamberlain. And Chamberlain was like, okay, so I'm going to do what I want to do, what I believe is best for the people of Great Britain, not what's obviously best for the people of France, even though he obviously paid lip service to that in what they later called the Franco-British solidarity. Like this is a relatively new time of the Brits and the French getting along. Like World War I was a first. They, for the vast majority of their nation's history, they didn't get along. So they wanted to preserve this Franco-British solidarity. Okay. So there were actually two different Sudeten crises, so to speak. There was the May crisis, and then there was the September crisis. Just to provide some background before we move on into September, in May, again, this is Hitler being somewhat of an operational and political genius here. In May, he was very much just bluffing. You know, the Anschluss happened in March. Hitler saw, like he could look at a map. He could see that he had basically done a fait accompli against Czechoslovakia. And he didn't even have that many divisions of the Wehrmacht on the Czech border. And he was just demanding a lot of things. Like he was just saying like, you know, this area should be free. Like it was a lot of rhetoric at that point. Well, this scared everybody. And in May, there were a lot of meetings. There were a lot of conferences. Chamberlain went to Germany, this, that, and the other. And essentially, he saw that the Soviet Union, the French, and the Brits were ambiguously saying, hey, like we're required to defend Czechoslovakia. The Brits had no treaty of mutual assistance, but they did with the French. At this time, there was like a formal alliance between the Brits and the French. So the Brits very much saw it as we're going to get drug into this mess, just like World War I because of the French. Like, hey, don't do this to us type deal.
You know what's interesting about that? And like, this is not a historical example, but there's a great book by a guy named Chris Voss called Never Split the Difference. Mm. And in his negotiation tactics, he talks about like throwing out an anchor. He's basically like, and this is a gross summarization, but he basically is like, just throw out like what you would consider an anchor in order to force the other side to then negotiate from that anchor. So yes. He's like, if you threw something so far one direction, he's like, even if you don't get everything, he's like, you're going to get way more than what you would. He's like, you're not splitting the difference. That's kind of what Hitler was doing with this rhetoric, like bluffing, making all these demands. He doesn't quite have the power to back it up at this point, but he's making all these demands and he's little by little gaining what he wants. He's just chipping away because he's throwing out this crazy anchor and all these other powers, so to speak, and leaders are then forced to act based on what Hitler is demanding, if that makes sense. So he, to your point about him being politically savvy at this point, he is, because he is forcing all these other European powers to play by what game he is setting the rules to.
Yeah. Yeah. Love the negotiation example. Another thing that is very applicable to understanding the situation is in negotiations, leverage is defined as how much you need what the other person has. And if they need what you want, but you don't need what they have, you have leverage over them. So it's like leverage is actually an imbalance in how much you need what the other person gives you. So for this example, Hitler had tremendous leverage over the French and the Brits here and the Czechs, because in his mind, you talk about that anchor. So in negotiations, there's a term called BATNA, B-A-T-N-A. It stands for best alternative to a negotiated agreement. What it's essentially like, what is the minimum, or if I don't get a negotiated agreement, what is the best alternative? Like, what do I want if I can't get a negotiated agreement? And that's what led to his leverage, because once you know what your BATNA is, you then can say like, okay, if I know what the best alternative is, the minimum thing that I can accept in this negotiation is it has to be better than what my BATNA is. Because if your minimum alternative or your minimum thing that you're going to accept in this negotiation is below your BATNA, then you shouldn't take the agreement, because your best alternative is actually better, if that makes any sense. I'm doing a lot of hand gestures. Sorry, y'all can't see this on the podcast.
We're going to have to start doing video. Our hand gestures are fantastic.
That's right. So the thing about Hitler in this whole Sudeten question was Hitler wanted a war. Hitler, I was planning on bringing this up later, but Hitler had already ordered his generals, what they called X-Day, for the invasion of Czechoslovakia to be October 1st. And that was the plan like 6 months prior to, this was back in May. Hitler was like, we're going to war. This is happening. So Hitler's best alternative to a negotiated agreement was World War II. And he knew that. He was willing to do it. And that's what gave Hitler so much leverage over the Allies at this point, was he was like, oh, you don't want to just give me absolutely everything that I'm asking for when I want it, that's fine with me, because my BATNA is actually acceptable. And that already like put the Allies in a pickle. And I think we would argue is like, well, what did the Allies do then? It's like, make your BATNA World War II as well. And as a matter of fact, when you also accept it's going to be World War II, that can kind of, to your point, Colin, about anchors, like it helps your frame of mind when you're in this negotiation, because you're thinking to yourself like, all right, war is a very real possibility here. We better make sure we win it. And we better make sure that we communicate to this person that we're negotiating with, like, hey, brother, you think World War II is acceptable, but I'm here to tell you that World War II will not be acceptable for you. Like, it will be painful. It will be miserable. You and your people will suffer. Nobody wants that. But precisely because they weren't, Hitler believed that World War II was going to turn out well for him. And that's why he was willing to accept it. So anyway, okay, bringing it back here to the May crisis was resolved because the Soviets were playing hardball at this time. And even though the Soviet Union did not have a lot of military leverage, like they didn't share a border with Germany, Hitler knew that his military wasn't quite ready. So in May, like the Seeferi line, which was opposite the Maginot line in the Rhineland, it wasn't done. It was like weeks away from completion. And they just didn't have enough troops to man, to do an invasion of Czechoslovakia and man the Siegfried Line at this time. So also in just the historical German psyche, fighting a two-front war is a really bad thing and a recipe for disaster. So when somewhat, even ambiguously, the British, the French, and the Russians gave a united-ish front, Hitler like overnight changed his mind and was like, okay, never mind. And they withdrew, and it kind of resolved things for now, but he didn't stop talking about the Sudetenland. So one last point before we get to September here is also, interestingly, at this point, was the closest the Wehrmacht came to doing a military coup. This is not the Valkyrie plot like had mentioned before. Yeah, it wasn't the Valkyrie plot. That wouldn't be later until 1944. But that was also like, they were pretty desperate at that point. In 1938, General Ludwig Beck, who was the chief of the German general staff, he had gone through extensive preparations for a coup. But when Hitler backed off, Beck backed off as well, because he didn't want to plunge the country into chaos, but he also didn't want Hitler to have his way and do bad things. Okay, moving on into September of 1938. So throughout the summer, especially into July, things got kind of bad. And, you know, weeks had passed, the Siegfried Line was complete. You know, they were adding tens of thousands of like troops, equipping them weekly. It was, you know, Germany is in the middle of an extremely rapid military buildup. So things began to deteriorate again in September. This time, as British and French military intelligence would say, they would see like there was a massive mobilization. The entire German army is on the Czech border. So what happens? The British, Chamberlain, immediately they saw like, hey, we were able to negotiate something good back in May. We can do it again. But they didn't know that the Germans were more prepared this time. And again, like Hitler wanted World War II, and he's willing to make it start over Czechoslovakia. So Chamberlain again, like, started sending off telegrams, and everybody's trying to appease Hitler, blah, blah, blah. And this is one of the more mind-blowing things, and why, like, the Munich, a lot of this pre-stuff for Munich doesn't get talked in detail in your standard World War II histories, because the Allies, Chamberlain, were such bad negotiators that, like, the initial proposals that they offered to Hitler were, hey, in all the territory in Czechoslovakia that is one half German, so just simple majority German, that Czechoslovakia would cede that to Germany. This was a British proposal. The British didn't ask the Czechs if that was okay. And
bold.
Yeah. They like just went VFR direct to, sorry, they went straight. No one knows what I'm saying when I say VFR direct.
If there's any pilots listening, you know.
Any pilots or non-pilots, controllers. Anyway. So Great Britain was already communicating to Germany prior to the Munich conference, hey, we, Great Britain, think that we can settle this question just between Great Britain and Germany. Mind-blowing. Like, initially, the British were even trying to leave the French out. Well, the Brits were communicating to Germany, but they were letting France know. This is a good point, good time to bring in the foreign minister. And this dude's going to come up again. So the foreign minister at this time in France was a guy named Georges Bonnet. Bonnet. And this dude was a coward. This dude is like next level. If we recall in our last episode, the foreign minister actually wanted, during the militarization of the Rhineland, he wanted Flandon. He wanted France to stand up to Germany. Well, that didn't bode well for his long-term success in the French government. So he was eventually replaced. This new guy, Bonnet, was him. And this dude was like frantic about avoiding a war. So much so that, you know, we've brought up the Parliamentary Investigating Committee after the fact. So much so that the investigating committee was like cringed at the levels in which this dude tried to subvert France's own national security in order to try to avoid war. Great case in point, he actually sent a telegram to the Czech government. The Czech president, Benet, was pretty firm. I would say he did the best he could. It was hard, like it's difficult to say if he was a strong leader because he did actually cave at the very end, but he only caved once it was abundantly clear that Czechoslovakia had been completely and utterly abandoned by all of their allies. So the French foreign minister, Benet, sent a telegram that said, in rejecting the Franco-British proposal, this proposal that they cede all land that have half Germans, in rejecting the Franco-British proposal, the Czech government assumes the responsibility for Germany resorting to force. It thus ruptures the Franco-British solidarity which has been established, and by doing so, it removes the practical effectiveness of assistance from France. This is like, honestly, like I still get a little heated just reading this telegram, because as we talked about spousal abuse in our episode or two ago, it's like, wait, can we read this again? The Czech government assumes the responsibility for Germany resorting to force? Like, what?
Hey, you guys didn't surrender fast enough, so sorry.
Sorry, it's your fault?
That is like the ultimate geopolitical victim blaming right there.
Dude, yeah, mind-blowing to me. And as a matter of fact, I'll do it now. In my mind, it is literally no different than the folks who say Russia invading Ukraine is America's fault or the West's fault, as some people have argued. It's like, well, it's really our fault that Russia invaded. What? How is it our fault? It's not our fault. If the point of those arguments is to say like, hey, there are things that we did to, you know, encourage Russia, embolden Ukraine, you know, blah, 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 blah. Like, okay, I get it. And that's just patently wrong. When you look at what Putin's rhetoric, and, you know, we did three episodes on this. Our first three episodes were on Russia, Ukraine, way back when. Forgive us if the audio quality is terrible, but, you know, Putin was primarily talking about the fact that Ukraine was a Nazi state. And
he did that intentionally. There are some in Ukraine, but he did that intentionally because he knows the rhetoric and what kind of the political scene in the West. So he knows Nazis are a hot button issue and an ingrained enemy of the West. So as soon as he shifts the narrative to he's fighting, he's denazifying, and we talk about it like the third episode, I think, that we did. The denazification of Ukraine, suddenly he is not an invader, but a liberator. And it can cause, best, a discourse in the West. At worst, it can cause outright, I'm trying to think of the right word for it, but I mean, at worst, it would cause like political turmoil in the West in order to take action. So like, what kind of decision making are we going to make?
Yeah. I think in the same way that the allies blamed, you know, would straight up say, Czechoslovakia, you're going to start World War II if you don't cave in. That's just people twisting the fabric of reality because they're so afraid of what the alternative is. Even in Russia, Ukraine, you know, again, I think I brought up like Tucker Carlson's recent visit to Russia just makes me sick. It's very similar to like CNN's like fiery, mostly peaceful protests. Like Tucker Carlson walking through, you know, there's like snow drifts that are taller than him. And he's like, this is nice weather. I really like the weather here. It's like, said no one ever. Like, you're a freaking wealthy New Englander. Like, come on, man. Like,
he's from California.
You like, you
he's from SoCal.
Oh, he's from Southern. Even better. Okay. Maybe he was educated in New England. He's Anglican or Episcopal. He grew up Episcopal. That's what I was thinking of. But anyway, point being is like, even the Russians don't like that freaking weather. Like, what are you talking about?
So they're always trying to invade and get out of there.
Yeah, it's like, it's just blatantly obvious. Your whole thing was to go be a Putin apologist. It's like, why? Why? I don't get it.
So I'm going to speak on what I mentioned about the leaders. Part of it is because there is the reason the resistance to Hitler was so tempered at best amongst the Allied nation was because they didn't have leaders that inspired any sort of courage or, yeah, I think courage.
Yeah.
Whether we want to believe it or not, nobody right now believes the current administrations in the West are worth fighting for. That's a problem. So yes. When you go, whatever your feelings are on the Tucker Carlson going there, and obviously you don't like it, as it's not an apologist, it's simply going and showing Russians will go fight for this guy. And in the West, we are, yeah, they will. They are.
I'll let you finish, but I got a thought there.
Apparently, they're dying in mass. And I promise you, the U.S. won't do that. The U.S. has two political factions, and neither one of them wants to go fight. A lot of them say they will and will post about it, but they won't. The other side doesn't want to at all. And it's because at every level of leadership, we have leaders who do not inspire any sort of courage, patriotism, morality. So a lot of people are looking around similar to prior to World War II and like, why am I going to go fight for this bozo? And it's a hard pill to swallow. Nobody wants to fight for rhetoric anymore.
Yeah, no, I agree with you 100%. Like from the emotional standpoint of, the current administration, the current president leaves one.
No confidence is inspired.
For looking for in, I feel like that's just not trying to be partisan. It's just like, that's just an objective reality
I mean.
That we
There's
live in right
two political factions, Republicans and Democrats, left and right. Neither one of them has any confidence. Even people that are going to vote for the current administration in the upcoming elections are only doing so because they don't like the other side.
Yeah,
there's no
It's a vote against Trump. It's not a vote for Biden.
Exactly. Yeah. At 100%. It is not a hope and change type of vote in 2008. It is a, oh God. Mm-hmm. I hate the other guy.
Yeah, which is a sad state of, I mean, this is a great point. And, you know, here at the Loins of History, we do like, I think it's one thing to be partisan, like, hey, I'm supporting a candidate just because it's my candidate for no other reason. It's another thing to call a spade, which we do want to do. We don't want to be partisan, but we do want to call a spade. And I think you're right. Like the reason why, you know, we talked about this in our very first episode on this series. There were a lot of French people who were supportive of fascism, even though fascism would be their doom, their undoing later on. Because exactly what you said, Colin, like it was the weak leadership and it was nothing to be proud of. And I think conservatives want strong leadership, generally speaking. Maybe everybody does. And those on the left are a little bit more covert about it, but you know, the Soviets were fond of saying power to the people, and yet Stalin showed up and, you know, and Lenin before him, right? So the only comment I wanted to make about people willing to die en masse, it's like, yeah, there's, you know, tens of thousands of dead Russians, but there's hundreds of thousands of military-aged Russian males that fled the country when the war started. So
there's more Ukrainians that fled because...
Oh, heck yeah. There were tons of Ukrainians that fled.
And that's every war. But my whole point is when you brought up the Tucker Carlson thing, it's like, yeah, it's kind of Fonda-esque on the tank in Vietnam, you know, where you're kind of like, huh, that's not really best. It's not a good look. Best.
No.
It's not.
Yeah,
a good
you're
look.
Right. No, that's a good way to put it.
And that's at best. It's not a good look. But his whole point was showing like, hey, if you want to fight somebody like this, or you want to go to war, or you want to have a country, you need to have a leader that has some level. You need to have leadership because U.S. were republic, representative elections. Got it. You need to have leaders who inspire greatness, inspire courage, inspire morality. We just straight up don't have that. And that's part of the problem of why, like, there's an eroding confidence in the West. It just goes back to leadership. And ultimately, you get the leaders you deserve, and it's downstream of all sorts of different factors. But right now, we have the leaders we deserve, and none of those leaders are inspiring any sort of change.
Yeah. No, you have the leaders you deserve. That's a great way to put it. Because even thinking about France, like, France had the leaders that they deserved at this time. And so did the Brits.
Yeah.
Now, the Brits would eventually turn it around, and I think Churchill would prove to be one of, not just in Great Britain, but in the last hundred, if not several hundred years, Churchill would be the best leaders. There's a reason Winston Churchill's bust, like his head and shoulders in stone, is all over Washington, D.C., in a way that I don't think, I mean, I don't have any data to back this up, but like, in a way that no other foreign leader is the same. Like, I'd be willing to bet there are more images and representations of Winston Churchill than any other non-American in Washington, D.C., period. And it's for a good reason. Like, Winston Churchill was the man. I love that guy. And anyway, we'll get back to Churchill before this episode's done, but for the sake of time. So after the French, like, communicated to the Czechs, like, we do not have your back. Interestingly enough, the Czech government accepted. The Czech government was like, okay, we capitulate, and they communicated that. And what happened? Chamberlain is like, I'm going to go in person. And he goes to Berlin, and on the 23rd of September, so about a week before the conference, you know, the Munich conference is not in mind here, but on the 23rd of September, Chamberlain flies to Germany. And he's like, here you go. The Czechs have accepted the Franco-British proposal. And Hitler responds with, they have 48 hours to leave the Sudetenland. And, you know, we've skipped over a lot of practical things that were being discussed. But, like, Hitler was like, in 2 days, everyone needs to be gone. The German army's marching in, which just wasn't realistic. You know, this is territory. You know, there's people here, people that live here. And it wasn't realistic to try to say, like, hey, you've got 48 hours to leave this area. Well, Chamberlain actually protested and was like, so this would become known as the Gettysburg demands or the Gettysburg diktat. And there was actually a very heated argument between Chamberlain and Hitler on these demands. And Chamberlain was actually not supportive at the time of giving him those demands. It's kind of funny. Chamberlain is quoted in this meeting as saying, like, this is nothing but nothing less than an ultimatum. And Hitler, who had presented these, you know, they got to leave right now and a series of other things in a memo or on a piece of paper. When Chamberlain was like, this is nothing short of an ultimatum, Hitler was like, it's not an ultimatum. Look, it says it right there at the top. It's just a memo. like in the most bizarre, like almost Michael Scott moment of this whole thing. Like, he's like, no, it's not a diktat. It's a memo. It says it right there.
I didn't give up. I declared it.
I didn't say it. I declared it. Yeah. Well, Chamberlain leaves pissed. And that was on the 23rd of September. Oh, sorry. One last thing. In the middle of Chamberlain and Hitler going back and forth, a German staff officer runs into this room and says, like, Der Führer, the president of Czechoslovakia just came over the radio and announced a full military mobilization. And that's what's crazy. Up until this point, the Czechs hadn't even mobilized. Well, then Chamberlain and Hitler start going back and forth about who mobilized first. And Chamberlain was like, you guys mobilized first. And Hitler was like, we're not mobilized, even though literally the entire German army is on the border of Czechoslovakia. Again, just Hitler wanted war. He wasn't about trying to negotiate. Well, which it made him a good negotiator if you're willing to go to war. We already talked about that. Okay. Well, Hitler leaves. Negotiations completely fall flat, even though they were going to give him what he wanted. And France mobilizes as well. So we are on the precipice of war at this point in time. So negotiations, you know, kind of continued over the next couple days. Well, the Italians finally get involved. And this is what fundamentally leads to Munich. On the 27th, you know, through the Italians, the British, and the French talking to one another, Chamberlain sends a letter to Hitler and says, hey, we will meet with, like, let's meet with the Italians. Let's do one last thing to hash this out. And remember, October 1st is what they called X Day, the day of the invasion. And Hitler comes back and is like, fine, meet me in Munich. Well, what the Allies didn't know is that the Italians and the Germans were talking to one another. And one thing that – so Mussolini told Hitler two things. He told him – so the Pact of Steel had already been signed. Italy and Germany were allies at this point, not just defensive allies, but straight up allies, i.e. Italy would help Germany in offensive action. But Mussolini, through his diplomats, told Hitler, hey, if you invade Czechoslovakia, if you start this war, we will not have your back. So that was the first thing. But the second thing Mussolini said, like, you need to support this conference and I will make sure you get everything that you want. And Hitler was like, okay. So that was kind of what led to the Munich conference after the Gettysburg demands, was the Italians saying, like, we won't support you in war, but we will make sure you get everything you want peacefully. So that led to, you know, less than 48 hours later, everybody flies to Munich or takes the train. Mussolini took a train to Munich, and that's what led to
on time.
That's right. Led to the Munich conference. Okay. We're finally at the conference here. So this whole conference at the very start was kind of a sham because I told you the Italians got involved. On the train ride up to Munich, Mussolini and Hitler's staffs basically were like, hey, we're going to jointly come up with all of our list of demands, everything that we're going to want, but we're going to pass it off as if it's this Italian proposal for peace. And if we remember in our previous episodes, you know, there was this thing called the Stresa Front, where the French and the Italians weren't necessarily enemies at this point, even though, you know, things weren't looking that great. Mussolini was not a big fan of Hitler, and Hitler was not a big fan of Mussolini. Like, there was a lot, even though they were both fascist countries, there was some, differences there. And Mussolini also wanted to maintain an independent foreign policy from Berlin. So the Allies were under the impression that Mussolini could be a impartial third party intermediary here. But what he didn't know was that he had already corroborated with Hitler to basically give him everything that he wanted. So on the train ride up there, they hammered out basically everything that Hitler wanted. So at the beginning of the Munich conference, this is the morning of September 29th, Mussolini starts off this conference and he gives what he calls the Italian proposal. This Italian proposal was absolutely everything that Hitler wanted. And for the rest of the day, the French and the Brits, which the French were represented by Daladier, the prime minister and minister of war, the Brits were represented by Chamberlain, and of course Hitler and Mussolini. It was just the four parties. One of Hitler's stipulations for even coming to Munich and doing this negotiation was that the Russians were not going to be invited and the Czechs were not going to be invited. And Hitler was extremely racist. He was known for saying things like, yeah, I don't want any dirty Czechs. Like, you know, earlier he would say things like publicly, he would say like, I don't want any Czechs in the Third Reich. But here he is demanding the Sudetenland, which included Czechs, by the way. So anyway, and he would later completely take over Czechoslovakia. Anyway, Mussolini gives the Italian proposal, and the Brits and the French that's the anchor that you were talking about earlier. You give him everything that he wanted, and the Allies would only have two big complaints, both from Chamberlain. Daladier was just, you know, there so he didn't get fined type deal, and Neville Chamberlain's two main issues were, one, whether or not Germany would compensate Czechoslovakia for public property that it was going to take in the Sudetenland. Kid you not. Number two, whether or not the Czech farmers would be allowed to take their cattle with them. Like, the most... And when Chamberlain brought this up, Hitler apparently exploded. The only two issues that Chamberlain brought up to this Italian proposal was, number one, whether or not Berlin was going to compensate Prague for the public property that it was going to take. And number two, whether or not the Czech farmers would be allowed to take their cattle with them when they left, to which
When Hitler heard this, he apparently exploded on Chamberlain. He's very, very, you know, it's not just in the movies that he yells all the time, like, exploded and said, "We do not have time for such trivialities." And it's like even Hitler recognized that, like, Chamberlain was just not a good negotiator. And so, and of course, on both of these things, they caved as well. So by 1 a.m. on the morning of September 30th, all four folks signed what became known as the Munich Agreement. And that was it. The Munich conference lasted less than 24 hours from the 29th of September into the morning of September 30th. And that was it. And they did allow, there were two Czech representatives who were not allowed to be in the room, and they were not the prime minister. They were like two low-level diplomats, excuse me, and they were allowed to be in an adjacent room. And after they signed this thing, like early in the morning, a British diplomat who was with Chamberlain allegedly told them, "If you do not accept, you will have to settle your affairs with the Germans absolutely alone. Perhaps the French may tell you this more gently, but you can believe me that they share our views. They are disinterested." And that was it. That's the Munich Agreement. You know, everyone kind of remembers Chamberlain for, you know, flying back and giving his infamous speech at the plane where he's like, "I hold in my hand peace in Europe," something like that. That was actually on the morning of the 30th, after they signed the agreement, after everybody got some sleep, Chamberlain, you know, again, groveled up to Hitler and asked for like an independent thing. What he was holding up was not the Munich Agreement. It was just a statement that had Hitler and Chamberlain's signatures on it only. And it was basically saying, if there are any further issues, Germany and Great Britain will settle them out together and peacefully. That was it. Daladier, you know, this is the fall of France here. Daladier, when he flew back to Paris, he was in the car driving back to the capital, and he the crowds were exuberant. Everyone was like cheering and glad that there'd be no more war. You know, we talked about public opinion in our last episode that, you know, everyone's super happy that there wouldn't be war. And Daladier allegedly looked at one of his aide, and he called the crowds. Looking at the crowds, he said, "The imbeciles, if they only knew what they were acclaiming." And this is the guy who just signed the Munich Agreement. So it's like Daladier, you can just see the defeatism, that he knew what he was doing was bad. And yet he just kind of seemed like a current, or, you know, like not a current, but someone being carried along with the current, like, you know, at the whims of the wind.
Some leaders acquiesce to the forces of nature, and some leaders bend the forces of nature to their will. And those Chamberlain and Daladier, and I made that up, by the way, just now. Chamberlain and Daladier, I mean, they were leaders that were bent by the forces of nature. They felt that were beyond their control. I mean, you're right. Daladier had defeatism, and he knew it was bad. He knew there was war. He knew that he was going to get conquered, and he just felt that there was nothing else he could do.
How much mindset plays a role in, like you said, in bending the forces of nature? Like, it is kind of where there's a will, there's a way. And Hitler had a will. The Allies just wanted to avoid conflict, and we know how that played out. Real quick, just want to talk about all the right-wing newspapers were very happy in Paris. One said, "Peace is won. It is won over the crooks, sellouts, and madmen." The few people that I haven't really talked about for the second time in the French government who were saying, like, "Yeah, I think we should take a stronger stand." Another newspaper said, "A few far-sighted and courageous leaders had triumphed over the war party." And the thing, you know, we've talked about this before, and I just wanted to mention now, is like, yes, hindsight is 20/20, but public opinion, and even, you know, the people that boldly talk about, it's a very common thing to say on the political left, how, like, you know, history, don't be on the wrong side of history. The irony here, you know, they talk about the progressive march of history, which is actually a Marxist formulation. Marxist was the one that, and communism was the one that kind of thought in these ways. That's why it's common on the left and the right to talk about being on the wrong side of history. You know, literally what these right-wing newspapers were saying, the exact opposite was true. And even though the crowds are you know, cheering, Daladier knew that they were imbeciles. One last quote here from, and this is finally, I've been talking about Winston Churchill, and I love because, you know, all these people were acclaiming, all these people were trying to avoid war. On the 5th of October, President Benet resigned and fled to London. He was the president of Czechoslovakia, the one guy that tried to stand up to Hitler. Churchill gave a speech in the House of Commons, and he started with, "We have sustained a total and unmitigated defeat." And when that first sentence came out of his mouth, he couldn't talk. The boos and the commotion, I'm sure, who's my source, he's the guy that wrote the Collapse of the Third Republic. He calls it a storm of protest. It was so loud that Churchill couldn't talk. And when things finally died down, he resumed, "We are in the middle of a disaster of the first magnitude. The road down the Danube, the road to the Black Sea has been opened. All the countries of Middle Europa and the Danube Valley, one after another, will be drawn in the vast system of Nazi politics, radiating from Berlin. And do not suppose that this is the end. It is only the beginning." And man, he was 100% correct. As we'll see, Hungary, you know, he was specifically talking about the Danube because he saw like Czechoslovakia was the one strong democracy in between Hitler and the Balkans. Hungary caved. Slovakia, which, you know, this rump state was that created, now part of Germany. Romania would get chipped away and chipped away and chipped away. We're not going to talk through those details, but like there were several different things. Yugoslavia even started offering up, like, just basically started giving away, offering up territory, Slovenia, to the Germans. And eventually that wouldn't even save them. Bulgaria started moving in Hitler's orbit. And he saw this on the October 5th. Churchill saw this on October 5th of 38. And I only bring that up to say, like, kind of what I was talking about Chamberlain earlier. Like, there were people who knew that this was a bad idea. Just one last thing, kind of we'll see. In our next episode, we're going to talk about how World War II actually got started. And it primarily revolves around Poland, right? We'll see. One of the main things, and I don't even know that I realized this before I started reading this book and doing research, is the act, like everyone knows the invasion of Poland is what started World War II, right? But the thing that gave Hitler the confidence to invade Poland was actually the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, which I knew that obviously played a role, but I didn't realize the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact was signed only days prior to the invasion of Poland. And the whole reason why the Russians started playing nice with the Germans was because the Russians here at Munich felt scorned. And that was like one of the first indications that Stalin kind of got that it was like, these dudes, like, they don't even invite me to be in the room to do these, and yet I'm supposed to be working with them. Like, I can't do this. So it's like they had isolated, the Allies had isolated the Russians. So the Russians were starting down the path to give Hitler permission to start carving up Eastern Europe that led to Molotov-Ribbentrop.
If I could summarize this episode, it's that, and apply it in today's term, it's that speaking and negotiating from a position of weakness and appeasement does not work. I'm not speaking from a position of peace. I'm talking about a position of appeasement and weakness. You can want peace all day, but if you are unable to enforce or keep the peace, you're speaking from a position of weakness and appeasement, and you will get run over. There is peace through strength. The Pax Romana is an example. Speak softly and carry a big stick. Yeah.
You're right.
I could summarize it. That's how I would summarize it.
As far as like international affairs, foreign affairs, whatever you want to call it, national security, that absolutely is the standpoint. I think just for the sake of time, not to spend too much time on it, but, you know, Taiwan is maintains a certain level of autonomy from China precisely because on multiple occasions, we put the U.S. Navy in the Taiwan Strait. There have been three total Taiwan Strait crises. I know for a fact at least the first two. Yeah. I don't know if the Clinton administration did
on it,
in the third one or if we just negotiated ourselves out of that one. But like, you know, we put American lives in between the communist Chinese and the Taiwanese before, twice at least, if not three times. And it's just like, that's why Taiwan is, you know, either free or autonomous, depending on who you ask. But you don't avoid war. You prevent war by having a bigger stick. That's the takeaway from this whole thing for me. And if you're not willing to do that, like, bad things happen in your country. Again, like, thinking about the collapse of France and the fall of empires, like, can lead to your own demise.
Jay, it was a good discussion on foreign policy and how it can apply today, comparing it to the Munich conference and the events that led up to it. So if you like what you're doing here, please like and subscribe. Leave us a comment. And if we'll give you a shout out, you can follow us on social media at various forms of Loins of History. And we enjoy your feedback. So we've gotten some good feedback from listeners before via comments and Gmail. So if you could reach out to us and give us any constructive criticism or suggestions. And we'll see you next week on the Loins of History.